I suppose the best way of introducing myself, other than the role that I play in the department, is that I am a historian, and particularly I am an oral historian. So I'm going to be talking about oral history. And I'm going to be giving a kind of overview of the last sort of 60 years of oral history and what I think that means and why oral history is a useful and indeed a more than useful, potentially transformative way of approaching history. I've been using oral history in my work for 15 to 20 years, and more recently I have begun teaching others about oral history. So it's a particular interest and methodological approach that I work with. So as I say, recently I've been supervising a large number of oral history projects, and even among those undertaken by inexperienced students and first-time interviewers, many have provided amazing insights and new revelations into the lives of different communities. One project looked at the origins and development of molecular biology in the 20th century by interviewing some of the key pioneers, and bear in mind these are student projects, as well as capturing something of the details of the processes of scientific discovery and professional rivalries in an emergent discipline. The interviewers uncovered really fascinating reflections on the protagonist's experience of race and ethnicity, and on the treatment of women in what was, and perhaps remains, a very male-dominated world of laboratory science. This rich and vivid material was all the more surprising, given it had not been the intention of the interviewer to particularly explore these areas, but rather had found several of her interviewees wishing to speak and reveal things about these things, to kind of unburden themselves, in a sense, about these areas. Another project also examined a similar theme, in a way, on the experience of women in the professional workplace, focusing on law and medicine in a period of rapid and almost revolutionary change in the workplace in the 1960s and 70s. These interviews personalised the stories of struggle, and going beyond the statistics of workforce demographics, gave the listener a real sense of what it was like and what it was required as an individual to be a pioneer in challenging male dominance and glass ceilings. Most remarkable for me in showing what is the potential for oral history were the interviews with members of a diasporic amateur football league, an interesting but perhaps rather limited subject area on first reflection. But what resulted was a series of fascinating interviews with eloquent young men speaking about their experience of migration, exile, family, national identities and a sense of belonging, and the role of the game and the league in providing a bond, a community, and a link between where the speakers had come from and where they now resided. In this brief talk, I will attempt to demonstrate why oral history as a methodology and a research approach can result in richer, more human histories of different communities, groups, and activities. I will do this by reflecting on some of the historical developments in the theory and practice of oral history over the last 60 years or so, by examining some contemporary projects amongst scientific communities, and finally, by briefly commenting on some of the possibilities for personal storytelling and autobiography in the digital age. Research-wise, I am interested in the democratising and empowering possibilities of oral, participatory and community history approaches. Those approaches which allow people to frame and construct their own historical narratives. But the key point I'll be making today is that whatever community you wish to study, and in this case perhaps that of an academic community, by using life history approaches, you have the possibility of constructing a collective biography of that community, peopled by real individuals with context and environment, a history which better explains the events and the responses to the challenges that that community experienced. So, first off, what is oral history? How does it differ from journalism and witness testimony, for instance? Although the interview is a key component of oral history does have some fairly specific characteristics which differentiate it from the interview. First, of course, it is usually historically focused, i.e. the subject can be near contemporary, but there is almost always a longer historical frame of reference. So even if you're looking at something that's happening almost contemporaneously or in a very recent past, you almost always wish to put it within a kind of longer context, within a life often. But also, unlike oral traditions, it tends to focus only on the first-hand memories and direct experience of one generation. Some oral historians will speak about what children know of their parents' experiences, but it rarely goes back any further than that. And in sort of pure oral history, it's the direct experience of one generation. Secondly, oral history is both a historical record, a physical historical record, being a recording of some sort, as well as being a historiographic approach by which that record is made. This notion of oral history as a methodology, which results in the active creation of a historical record or an archive through the interaction of two or more individuals, and it's the interaction is key, the interviewer and the narrator, is for me a core concept. The formal origins of modern oral history as a definable historical practice and a record are traced back to the establishment, are generally traced back to the establishment in 1948 by Alan Nevins of the Oral History Research Office at Columbia University, with other programs following soon after at universities in California and Texas, and then onwards, including presidential libraries and other things. As a journalist and a historian, Nevins had been interested in this subject since the 1930s, though it took him to 1948 to raise the finances and raise the sponsorship to establish the programme. But since the 1930s, he'd been writing about using interviews and testimony to produce more vibrant, more peopled histories. But in fact, the first systematic attempts at oral history by Nevins and others tend to be what we would refer to as elite interviewing. These early interview programmes largely aimed at capturing the thoughts, the memories, the experiences of prominent figures from the worlds of politics, business and justice. In Nevin's own words, he was interested in recording the experiences of Americans who have led significant lives, the emphasis being on significant. But there was a strong element of recovery, even in elite interviewing at this stage. Because the idea that particularly motivated Nevins was his concern that developments in office technology and in culture generally, notably, or perhaps most obviously, the phone replacing the letter, meant that the records that had previously been available to document the thoughts and actions of leading politicians and scientists and business leaders would not be available to future historians. And thus the gap left by those records, or the lack of those records, must be filled, must be actively created by the recordings of direct testimony and interviews. And it's a really kind of, it's an interesting connection and sort of has resonances today for archivists about what's missing. And how we kind of sort of deal with what's missing from the historical record, the archival record in a digital era. However, outside the US, notably in the United Kingdom, oral history developed as a very different approach, with a very different perspective. Rather than being an approach associated with elite history, in the United Kingdom, oral history was embedded in recovery, but this time recovery from below. Many traditional historians in the UK were for a long time reluctant to utilise oral history and interviewing. Instead, it was embraced first by local historians and particularly by folklorists like George Ewart Evans. Then, in the 1960s and the early 1970s, the development of new social history, women's history, labour history and others meant that a new generation of historians, frustrated, as in this quote from Ralph Samuel, with the bureaucratic bias, or what they perceived to be the bureaucratic bias of much history, which resulted from the sources. So Samuel's argument here, I think somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but the way it's expressed, is that it's not historians' fault that they're writing boring administrative history. It's because the only sources they have to write their history are boring administrative bureaucratic sources, and that forces them into a particular direction. Historians seeking to write different sorts of histories therefore went looking for new sources, including oral histories, which would allow them to explore what would become known as history from below, and recover those who Sheila Rowbottom described as being hidden from history. It was these historians and these perspectives that came to dominate the UK oral history landscape in a way quite different from in America. Although the methodologies and approaches have changed and evolved over the years, as the UK National Sound Archivist Rod Perks has recently argued, in contrast with the more pluralist US discipline, oral historians in the UK have continued, for the most part, to be focused on local communities, histories from below, recovery, and the stories of what might be considered somewhat marginalised by society. Significantly, while oral history was embraced by these radical historians as a way of recovering and populating history with new, previously unrepresented subjects, it was also about transforming the way history was written, and by whom. And from here, we have the potential to transform the writing of any history, including the most traditional and elite-based studies. By this way of thinking, oral history, and in particular life history as a methodology or an approach, offer the possibility of new alternative avenues of exploration. Particularly under the influence of feminist and feminist-inclined writers, oral history enabled a study of history, of histories that were more inward, more private, and more domestically focused, started to look internally into motivation rather than action. Naturally, this approach provoked much criticism. Some of this is well known. The H.A.P. Taylor quote is often quoted, although I've never actually been able to trace it back to its original, but old men drooling about their youth is quite a nice description of oral history, and Barbara Tuckman's trivia of appalling proportions as a kind of sort of sense of the criticism that was aimed at oral history. Particularly this kind of emergence of this kind of sort of more radical perspective and approach, which was both a critique of traditional history, but actually is linked with a critique of society at large. And so a lot of this criticism is not just historical and methodologically inspired, but it's also politically inspired. So oral history was dismissed as being unscientific, unreliable, based on flawed memory and recollection rather than contemporary and authentic documents. And it was suggested that the interviews they produced, and these things were trivial and without long-term historical value. The most famous and influential response to this criticism and advocacy for oral history's potential for transforming history into something radical and democratising was Paul Thompson's The Voice of the Past, first published in 1978 and regularly revised and reissued ever since. The first purpose of the book, and if you read the earlier versions as opposed to kind of, sort of the later editions, it's the strongest purpose of the book, was as a almost kind of sort of positivist critique of or refutation of the criticisms of oral history, that oral history was unreliable. So Thompson spends a lot of time refuting that and saying, no, oral history, you can test it against other things and it is absolutely reliable. And as we'll see, that's kind of a position that changes for oral historians towards the end of the 70s and 80s. His other part was, purpose of the book, was to stress this transformative purpose. So it linked, oral history is linked very much to a kind of sort of a political conception of history, of a kind of, sort of democratisation process. And this you can see in this quote from the book from early on, the two elements to that. One is a transformation of the content and of the subject of history, sort of throwing all the barriers, all the boundaries open and saying all these things are worthy of historical study. But crucially also the second part. And the second part is not just about content, it's about who writes history, whose voice appears in history, who has the kind of ability to be part of the production and the construction of history. And both these ideas are kind of sort of quite key, bound up in the kind of sort of development of oral history in the UK and elsewhere. You could follow after through the kind of sort of the from Thompson onwards a whole kind of sort of series of movements and attachments to oral history, which are adopting this idea about kind of trying to transform the production of history, transform the kind of sort of relations about who has sort of a primacy and a control over the narrative. You can think of things like history workshop, community histories, feminist history and theory, the use of oral history in development studies and development education, and indeed in radical political education. In essence, in these hands, oral history was seen as a tool for decentering authority, the decentering of the authority of the academic historian or interviewer, and giving prominence to the voice of the narrator, promoting through participation in acts of recovery and authority a greater sense of empowerment and collective memory. Even in situations of the most sharp and dangerous political struggle, such as in South Africa in the 1970s and 80s, oral history as an approach to telling your own history was seen by some as an important component of the political education for those struggles. Now, as I suggested earlier, it was undoubtedly true that in the US, elite history represented the origins of oral history and remains to this day a significant trend. However, in the 1970s, they saw a similar to the UK growth in oral and community history projects, which sought to document histories from below. And while some were motivated by a civil rights and identity politics agenda, there was a strong strand of popular local community histories, which drew inspiration for the extremely popular and influential Studs Terkel, and emphasised the sense that every voice mattered, every story counted. And the second half of this quote is the interesting bit, or from a book called Working in 1972. He's talking about, you know, going and talking to elites. He uses the word celebrity. It can be used to capture the celebrity, but the answers of the celebrity are ever ready and flow through all the expected strengths. Doesn't tell you anything new. I've yet to be surprised by one. It can also be used to capture the thoughts of the non-celebrity, and those statistics, so ordinary people only really appearing in history and statistics, become persons, each one unique, and I am constantly astonished. And this is incredibly influential, particularly in America, but also on this side of this kind of sort of sense of every story matters, every voice counts. And many of these projects presented the testimonies as the authentic voices of the people, and there's a quotation marks around this, or the word authentic, speaking without intervention or mediation by academic historians. Although this portrayal ignored the role of the interviewer in the construction of oral history. The emphasis was on the stressing of the voice of the community, the validity of the stories recorded, and the positive impact it had on the speaker. And this tradition, as I say, continues very, very strongly up to this day. It's one of the kind of sort of two main, there's a kind of sort of academic side to oral history, and then there's a kind of sort of popular community, this kind of sort of every voice matters. And this is a screenshot from StoryCorps, which is this kind of huge initiative in the States, which they, I think since early 2000s, has been going around the country, setting up booths for people to record their own stories, and there isn't a formal interviewer, so you interview your friend or you interview your family member, and those are then archived and made available for everybody. You get about 40 minutes to tell this story, and then some of them each week are played on National Public Radio on a Sunday morning. But it's this kind of sense of, well, we're allowing people to speak for themselves, to tell their own stories. We've taken out any sense of reflexivity or a critical voice or an interviewer or a historian in this process. There have been a number of academic worries about the value of such more democratic methods, and these have come, interestingly, from the left as well as from the traditional historians that we counted earlier on the right. Simply put, many have questioned the lack of theoretical rigour of community and oral history productions, which purport to represent the authentic voice from the margins. It's been deemed impossible for the mere history of salvage and resurrectionism, and these terms are not used in a positive way, to accurately reflect the authentic and pure of the voice of the powerless, let alone empower those voices. Particularly critically viewed are those kind of celebratory and non-reflexive accounts which are deemed, you know, to be particularly problematic. So communities or organisations approaching their 100th anniversary and sort of interviewing the great and the good and then putting those out without any sense of kind of critical reflection on that. About the same time as these arguments were being made about the kind of validity of this type of oral history, the approach was being further transformed from within by those who saw the necessity of moving it away from uncomplicated, naturalistic and anecdotal approaches into something much more sophisticated and nuanced. And this relates back to this point about Thompson seeking to refute the critics of oral history on a kind of sort of positivist base. Now, people like Portelli no longer are interested in, or not primarily interested in, the kind of sort of defending the validity and the reliability of oral history as fact. They're much more interested now in seeing oral history as a methodology for exploring memory, for thinking about silence, for thinking about what is not said as much as what is said. And I said it's most famously associated with the work of the Italian historian Alexandra Portelli, and it's been written of as a kind of paradigm shift in oral history theory and practice. Portelli and those who followed him celebrated the subjectivity, partiality and unreliability of some elements of oral history, not anymore as a weakness, but as a strength. It was the unreliability, it was what people said when actually they may have said something very different a few years earlier, or that said something that didn't actually bear resemblance to what actually happened, that became of interest to the oral historians. This became a way of studying memory, orality, collective and individual consciousness. In addition to the new concentration on memory and the construction of meaning rather than history as it happened, the influence of feminism and women's studies and writers like Michael Frisch led oral historians to emphasise the importance of examining the interview and the relationships within it, to prioritise the ethics of interviewing and the popularisation of perhaps the most important principle in modern oral history practice, the concept of shared authority. That is the attempt to equalise the power relations between the interviewer and the interviewee, and to acknowledge and support at all points through the process the narrator's authorship and authority over his or her words. For the most part, contemporary oral historians have accepted much of the arguments put forward in these more theoretical and subjective approaches. Most experienced interviewers are conscious of the need to obtain consent and to share authority with the interviewee, and to look beyond the account and account of history as it was, and to probe behind that for meaning and memory. Nevertheless, to a certain extent, with elite interviewing, and more significantly amongst some community projects, there remains a belief in objectivity and the empowerment of allowing every voice to count, and a rejection of these more over-theoretical positions, or characterised as over-theoretical positions, which sometimes lead the interviewer to question and reinterpret the validity of what the interviewer had said. Now, some brief reflections on some kind of practical or practice-based approaches. That's the kind of sort of the theoretical basis around oral history. As we've seen since the beginning of the study, of elite individuals and communities has been a significant strand of oral history practice, particularly in the US. There, business organisations and scientific academic communities have frequently sponsored or funded oral history projects out of either vanity or, more significantly, out of a sense of the valuable organisational, corporate, disciplinary memory and knowledge that might well be lost without a program directed at deliberately recovering and capturing that knowledge. In a 2003 review of the oral history of American science, Ronald Dole demonstrated some of the breadth of the oral history projects, which since the 1950s have sought to document the development of various different scientific communities inside and outside the universities. Crucially, these oral histories have reflected the broader changes in oral history practice and thinking. Moving from a more limited approach of asking very focused questions of a few key individuals about very specific occupational and disciplinary matters, to a project more interested in the social and cultural development of ideas and discovery by adopting life history approaches, i.e., even when there is a focus on a specific part of a person's life, so their particular occupation, life history approaches seek to understand the whole of that life, to see, to put that main focus, that occupation, in the context of the whole life. This approach, in Dole's words, can yield important insights about disciplines and intellectual communities, all the while focusing on individual storytellers, their social and professional contexts, and their world views. As Rob Perks has demonstrated, for the most part, British oral history has been little focused on corporate and organisational memory, preferring history from below. That is not to say there are no examples of such initiatives, particularly with an academic or celebratory context. Many communities of practice, including the heritage and information professions, have made oral history recordings of their early pioneers, depositing the resulting records and interviews with the National Sound Archive. And you won't be able to see it very clearly, but this is links to the catalogues in the National Sound Archive around museums, archivists and librarians. The National Life Story Initiative has, over the last 20 years or so, again based within the National Sound Archive, sought to record and reveal all aspects of the nation's life, including the corporate and the academic world, so often ignored by more conventional oral history practice. One of the most recent projects in this vein is the Oral History of Science in Britain, which again is part of the National Life Stories kind of umbrella. This initiative has very clearly adopted the same life history approach to understanding scientific work described by Dole. And in their literature and in their kind of sort of their methodology documents, they contrast the earlier, shorter interviews done with British scientists, which tended to focus entirely on significant discoveries and inventions, and just look at those moments. The life story approach will illuminate the process of science, the intrinsic attitudes of scientists, and will describe the life, routines, and human emotion associated with scientific work. What the attempt to get at is to place these working lives within a broader social and cultural context. So finally, or nearly finally, to bring the discussion right up to date, Alistair Thompson has written of the impact new technologies and the digital environment might have on oral history as the latest paradigm shift. He denotes four paradigm shifts, of which the Portelli's memory was the second. This is felt most clearly in the transformative manner in which oral history materials are increasingly accessed and used, suggesting a shift to what Michael Frisch has called a post-documentary sensibility. But also crucially, and the most of the kind of attention was focused on how oral histories can be used and utilised. But crucially, I believe the manner by which the material can also be recorded and contributed is equally transformed. The ready access to devices and laptops, mobile phones, etc., all of which are capable of recording pretty high standard interviews, is one aspect that offers what's called kind of the sort of possibilities of democratisation or further democratising history. But so does the impact of increasingly participatory and online approaches to storytelling and life history. As the technology has got progressively more collaborative and participatory, the instances of individuals and communities creating and sharing personal and collective histories and memories online without any professional or academic support has continued to grow and to kind of just blossom. Now, there are clearly distinctions between some of the things that I've put here. You have kind of what I would refer to as repositories of life materials, not something like Facebook where you can just stick materials. You're not really constructing a narrative, you're not deliberately constructing a narrative. So, whereas you get into things like digital scrapbooking, digital storytelling, where people are telling their life story, they are using different ways to deliberately put together materials which illustrate a narrative. What this latter development might mean for oral history and community history projects is hard to predict. Some have claimed that this points away to the further democratisation of history. There's references to the triumph of the unmediated voice and an autobiography, and there's a really horrible word, which I think I take some responsibility for making even worse, which is the autobiographizing of history. So sort of turning oral history into a kind of autobiographical moment, removing that sense in which there's a kind of it's a dialogue between two people. And Alistair Thompson in particular has wondered whether this uploading of individual unmediated memories represented a problem. It represented a position in which in the future the historian might be totally frozen out of these kinds of accounts. There is also a question of how this material might be collected, harvested and made available for future research. The late Roy Rosenberg wondered whether online soliciting of life stories and memories might represent a cheaper, more effective way of obtaining individual personal oral history accounts than actually going out and recording them. The answer to these questions depends on the significance you place on the interviewer and the rigour of the interview in creating something more critical and reflexive. Something more like a historical record in our original definition of oral history. Or whether it is in capturing diversity of voices and stories which primarily motivate you. So what should be the role of the academic historian or professional oral historian in community history projects? The answer to these dilemmas lies in the definition of the community studied, the type of ownership that community wants over its history, and the type of history you are seeking to create. Some historians, such as Linda Shopes, reflecting on past projects, are extremely critical of their lasting value because of the lack of rigour, critical reflection, and the failure to challenge the narrator's account and frequent and overly celebratory and unrepresentative notions of what a community is and what its history represents. However, to accept that there is merit in these arguments does not mean that you do not recognise the potential for rigorous, empowering, life-changing histories in community history projects. The balance between rigorous interviewing and giving preeminence to the narrator's voice is an important balance and can result in very different histories. But one is not necessarily better than the other. It depends on your intention. So finally, oral history, I believe, is evidently a fruitful and powerful methodology for the recovery of histories which are in danger of being lost, forgotten, or marginalised. Done well, it provides the means to populate those histories with real people with real lives and backgrounds, to examine motivations behind actions. And as such, it is as relevant an approach to the recovery of the origins and history of an academic community of practice as it is for a local working class community or a disappearing occupation, otherwise largely absent from the official records. By taking a prosopographical or collected biographical approach to community histories, life history and oral history offer the opportunities to go beyond the well-known and the obvious, and to include the lesser known or overlooked. And it seeks to understand and document not just the facts of immediate concern to the study in question, but also the context which framed and underpinned those developments and actions. In other words, it seeks to humanise otherwise rather dry and sometimes partial accounts. Thank you.